Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Continuing with our conversations with remarkable minds, looking back at the biology of belief and epigenetics during the past decade, examining how our emotional states, our early life experiences, the type of conditioning, and the environment that we were raised in impacts us today. We are nothing if we're not always looking for solutions and answers. Tens of millions of people each day awaken with all forms of stressors, and yet they still try to persevere. They try to understand, why am I depressed? Why am I anxious? Why do I have heart disease or cancer? How do I approach the changing of these different millennium throughout history and learn from all the people who have preceded me, all the great minds? Different people have different ideas about life. My guest today is exploring all that with us. He is Professor Bruce Lipton. He is an international authority on the new emerging biology into cellular activity and on the interface between science and spirituality. From 1987 to 1992, he was a researcher at Stanford University School of Medicine. Among his discoveries was identifying a mechanism in cells that function like a brain, and the founding of a field of cellular biology known as epigenetics. He is now recognized as one of the leading voices in the new biology, as well as mind-body medicine. A decade ago, Bruce's book, The Biology of Belief, became a landmark work uniting mind, body, and cellular science with spirituality and introduced his and others' discoveries in molecular biology, quantum physics, and the emerging field of epigenetics. His other books include Spontaneous Evolution and The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. And you can learn more about Bruce and his appearances at his website, brucelipton.com. Nice to have you with us today, Bruce.
Gary, thank you so very much. And I'm honored to be on your show, and I so appreciate the whole message of helping our world evolve. That's been your life, and thank you for it.
And I don't look at today as what is most essential. I also have to honor all the people who have preceded us that sometimes are forgotten or even taken for granted. And that said, when I look back at Freud and Jung and Adler and all the other psychotherapists and psychologists, philosophers, Spinoza, Maimonides, they all had something in common. They all believed that the conditioning that we were exposed to would manifest later in life as who we are today, the uniqueness of our personalities, either positive, negative, or some combination. And not now, but a little bit on, I want to get to that, how many of the things we do today, many of the things we may do that are self-defeating, self-sabotaging, are actually conditioned responses from earlier in life that we're just not conscious of, and therefore confuses us. I read today that more Americans, mainly white men, in their 40s and 50s are committing suicide or dying of liver disease from drinking or in some way prematurely dying way before their time. And this is a first because historically we have been extending the lifespan. Now it's reversing. One of the reasons they suggested was because people simply did not have proper coping mechanism. They did not know what to do when faced with many of the overwhelming problems. Now, let's just go through these briefly. And this is only a small part. Financial distress in probably three-quarters of the American population. They simply do not earn enough and or have saved enough in order to be able to have a quality of life or standard of living that they or their dependents are used to. As a result, they fall through the cracks and are extremely stressed about that. And also, we lie about our unemployment figures. We take out of that unemployment figure anyone who cannot find a job or has a job that doesn't pay a sustainable living or those who have simply stopped looking. And we're dealing now with over 15 million of those. So the actual number of Americans who could work but are not working is over 65 million. And yet we play this game, this stupid and vile game that we only have 5.3% unemployment. Then we have the problem in relationships. Historically, the relationship you had early in life was the relationship that you tried to sustain through life. Part of that relationship was having an extended family. Therefore, you weren't left alone in the problems you faced. You had, and in some cultures to this day, especially in the Middle East and in Latino communities and South American communities, you have an extended family. So you don't have to bear the full burden of a problem. You have aunts, uncles, wise men and women who come together and give you their input. And because of the respect that you are conditioned to believe in, then those people become an essential part of your life. The average American today, they're disconnected from all that, and especially the younger generation. We have an entire generation that is disconnected, with some exceptions, from any responsibility for the choices they make. As a result, those who could work to lessen the financial stress upon their parents choose not to. They don't want to be bothered with it. Or they don't like the work, or feel it's beneath them, or they're not going to make enough money, so why? Why care? And yet someone is paying the bill for that college education. More often than not, it's a parent or grandparent. Over 12 million senior citizens are now impacted by the debts of others. That had never happened historically. You were expected to be financially solvent. You were expected to have the meaning and purpose of your life by the age of 30, 35, and therefore honor it and live it out. Today, you have people up to 35 years of age who are clueless about who they are, what to believe in, what their values should be, and unfortunately, they have been spoiled, in my personal opinion, and again, there are exceptions. I want that noted. But for the vast majority of young people today, they are not held accountable for their actions. As a result, the sense of empathy, community, caring about others, nature, animals, is simply non-existent. Because someone has always said, oh, you're too precious and you're too perfect and it's not your fault. And when you're told enough times it's not your fault, and one day you wake up, you don't look at anything as being your fault. Therefore, whatever you do, so be it. Someone else will pay for it. And the philosophy epigenetically, if you don't pay for a lesson and someone else has to, are you ever obligated to learn it? And then we have a large generation of senior citizens. And this is probably the saddest group of them all, because most of these people have been noble, have been honest, have lived a life of integrity and character, and now they've been abandoned. Many of them, through no fault of their own, are in debt. They didn't spend foolishly. It's just that many times their pensions were reduced, or gone completely, stolen by corporations that took over their businesses. And the cost of living today is so high with rents or the maintenance of life and medicines and food that they can't have it all. So they're living lives of desperation, but because they have no constituency representing them, they are hidden. We don't see them. We don't see their suffering. In my film, Poverty Inc., I did. And it was saddening. Then we have a business environment in the United States where the economy of Wall Street does not represent anyone else. If every single bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs, if all of these were to go through structured bankruptcy tomorrow and be completely eliminated, it would not impact America at all. Now, that may seem heretical, but if you have enough background in economics and you study, their economy has been their own economy. In derivatives, credit default swaps, they don't build factories. They don't hire people at living wage. In fact, if anything, they're the grim reapers. When they come into your community as an equity partner and they take over your company, they downsize it. They have caused more than 30 million Americans in the last 40 years to lose their jobs by corporate raiding, taking over corporations, outsourcing it to China. How do you think people deal with that? The people who are responsible for this, who have no sense of mercy or community, and those who are the victims who don't know what to do. They haven't organized. They don't know how to organize. And then they end up overeating, drinking, maladapting. We are a nation of maladapters. We have the more people watching worthless, stupid television reality shows, voting in elections that they know are not going to make any difference, and always voting for the wrong people, Democrats or Republicans, a banking system that they're using their credit cards, and if the industry and the credit card industry wants and hopes you don't make a payment so they can charge you extra, and then you buy things you don't need that are obsolescent very quickly with money to pay it back you don't have. We're living on debt. And then one day we wake up and we have heart disease, cancer, we're obese, we're the fattest nation in the world. We have more depression and anxiety than any other population in the world per people. Our children are obese. People are broke. They have no savings. Relationships are frayed. And then we look at someone on PBS hoping that, you know, if we all clap our hands and say positive things and put out good visions, the world will turn around for us, like with The Secret. That's the world that I'm asking you now to address through the unique lens of epigenetics. Take your time. The forum is yours.
Maybe I can reference it with a quote from Tony Benn. He's a member of Parliament, a liberal member of Parliament in London, and his quote was exactly this. He said, governments do not want a healthy, intelligent population because they're very difficult to control. And from my age, I go back over 60 years ago and see it today, and I think, my God, in the short time, we were the healthiest and most intelligent nation in the world, and now that's completely gone. And you might say that was a coincidence or an accident, and I have to say I don't believe that for a second. And I have to then bring in the nature of understanding of some new biology, where it's new biology, but it was an old idea that people have known for a long time. And the old idea is actually as old as 1600. It was in 1600 that I think it was St. Francis Xavier, a Jesuit, said, give me a child until it's seven and I will show you the man. And people never really recognize, you know, what the heck is he saying when he says that? And the answer is this. If I get your first 7 years and I program you in the first 7 years, I control the outcome of your life. Now, that was known by function. Today we have a science that explains that. And the significance about that is also very important because it ties in with our belief in Darwinian theory. So we have some issues here about belief systems and programming. And the Darwinian theory program, which was generated in Victorian England and gave justification for an upper class to rule over a lower class, is a theory that that people remark and they say, yes, it's life is a struggle for survival with a competition for fitness. And it's the fittest, the survival of the fittest. And I say, well, interesting words, fittest. I say, well, what's the word fit mean? And here's interesting, definition of fit, capable of surviving. Well, if it's survival of the fittest, and that's the fittest, I said, well, there's fit people, and then there's some people a little more fit, the fitter people. And then I say the most fit people are the fittest people. And so all of a sudden you start to realize, what have we been saying? We say survival of the fittest. Yeah, what about the fitter and the fit? And all of a sudden you start to realize there's an issue that said in science, and unfortunately political leaders are following this very old science, and that's a Darwinian belief, which is actually from Thomas Malthus, that the population will increase so much that there will be no food left, and so eliminating the population is actually a biological necessity to prevent us from facing that ultimate struggle of not having enough food. So I say I put all these things together, the programming, the belief that there is an upper class and that they, you know, that they are the fittest and that they are worthy of evolution has been a program in us. And also, we've been programmed to lose control of our health. The interesting thing about the health issues today, we look at the whole range of health issues, and I can tell you very simply, less than 1% of all disease on this planet is actually due to genetics. The rest of it is all due to lifestyle, stress being the biggest issue, and environment causes, Gary, that you know well and have been working on for a long time. And the idea about that is there's a way of eliminating a population. You can eliminate them by war, or you can eliminate them by disease. And this is not a new idea. This is built into the whole nature of the political science behind Darwinian theory that says you must limit the population. So when you have a war, And then they say, oh, our finest and bravest young men. It's like, well, that's not necessarily true. It's the lower people that can't get a job that end up being your soldiers. And for the higher ups, there are higher ups, and it's like we need to regulate the population. So having a war is not a big deal for a government. It leans it out, so to speak. So put all this together, I say, look, there are programs. We have been programmed. The Jesuits have known us since 1600. Today's programming is much more effective than before. And I say relevance is this. The story or the movie called The Matrix is, it's called science fiction. Yet the reality of The Matrix is that it's more of a documentary. That the first 7 years of our life is a programming period. And the brain is designed to, consciousness is not a predominant brain state until after seven. The first 7 years, our primary brain state is theta. Theta is imagination, and that's why, of course, kids, especially between 2 and 7, mix the real world and the imaginary world seamlessly because their brain is operating at this frequency, theta. And so if they're riding a broom and the mother says, give me the broom, and they say, this is not a broom, this is a horse, they actually, in that experience, were riding a horse. So they're mixing imaginary and real. But it turns out it's also period of programming. Theta is hypnosis. And you say, well, why would you have that? Why would nature do that? And the answer is you can program so much by genetics, but culture and environment, things like that, you can't program that. A child has to learn it. When a child is born, it's going to be part of a family and a community. And I say, well, what's the relevance? I say, you know how many rules and regulations it takes to be a functioning member of the community? And a child has to download this really early. And there's, so many nuances. How a parent talks to a child is not the same way a parent talks to another adult or the same way a parent talks to a policeman. And you start to realize there's all these nuances. I said, well, how do you teach somebody that? And the answer is you really can't. I mean, it's way too much. I said, well, oh, nature handles it. By the first 7 years of your life, your brain is operating in theta, which is a hypnosis, so you're not even working with your conscious mind. You're downloading and observing everything around you, and it's all being downloaded as programs, how your parents respond to life, how they relate to each other, how they relate to the world, how your siblings relate, how your community relates. So a child is endowed with the ability to download all of this programming. You say, well, why should I download it? And simple analogy is you go to the Apple store, you say, I want to buy a new iPod, and you get the new iPod out, and the front screen, the touch screen, it's the creative screen. It's the one where you can make playlists and adjust the volume and, rewind. You can do everything, control it. And so I get a brand new iPod, I take it out of the box, and I push play, and nothing happens. And people say, well, that's silly. Of course, you can't play anything because you didn't download any programs. Oh, so the hard drive with the programs is really needed. You have to have programs first before you can create a playlist. It's obvious. In our nervous system, the subconscious is tantamount to the hard drive, and the conscious mind is the creative one. So basically, you can't be conscious if you don't have any data. So the first 7 years, nature designs as a download. And this is how you learn this complex behaviors. And it goes in your subconscious mind. And it's not proofed or reviewed by your conscious mind because your conscious mind's not functioning. So whatever got downloaded, whether it was a good program or a bad program, they're just downloads. And then I say, well, at about age 7, consciousness kicks in. And that's when you start using the programs that you acquired, and now you're like, you have your hands on the wheel, you're driving this vehicle with your conscious mind. So the issue about that is in our fundamental ways of dealing with life and how we deal with stresses and how we deal with each other and our relationships and what we expect from life and everything, our vision, our view of life is a program that's downloaded in the subconscious. But then you kick in with a conscious mind. The conscious mind is the unique mind that makes us who we are. Conscious mind is the creative mind. It's the mind that says, listen, what are you doing next Wednesday? What relevance? If you can actually envision what you're doing next Wednesday, you're thinking into the future. And that's like, ah. And if you can think in the future, you can create into the future. So basically, conscious mind is creation. Subconscious mind is habit. It's just got programs in it. Okay, so now you start to become conscious. Then we also start to use our mind for thinking. And I go, relevance? And relevance is this. I can run my life with my conscious creative mind, which has, by definition, wishes, desires, aspirations. What do you want from life? That's your conscious mind. That's your creative mind. I say, yeah. Now, the creative conscious mind also has another issue. It can think into the future, as we talked about. It can review the past. It can go into your head. If I say, so what are you doing next Wednesday at 7 o'clock? If you actually entertain what to answer that question, by definition, you have to think about it. And I say, well, the moment you're thinking about it, you're not paying attention. I go, oh. So I say, oh, when you're thinking, the conscious mind is not paying attention to the world outside. Well, it doesn't mean everything stops. I mean, you're walking along, you have a thought, you don't freeze and then have the thought go and then start walking again, or driving the car, having a thought, you don't crash the car. I mean, so what happens? Here it is, and this is critical. The moment the conscious mind is thinking, behavior by default is switched to the subconscious program. I go, what's the relevance? I go, well, the basic subconscious programs that you have didn't come from you. They came from your parents, family, and your teachers. And I go, well, wait a minute then. So that means when I'm thinking, the behavior I play by default, whether I'm walking, driving the car, or having a conversation, my default, that program is going to, what I'm going to be playing is the program that came from a subconscious, which has habits, how to deal with things. So it says, oh, okay, so when I'm using my conscious mind, it's like driving a car, you have hands on the wheel. But when your conscious mind is thinking, by definition, you run the vehicle by autopilot, subconscious. I go, yeah, but the subconscious programs don't have your wishes and your desires and what you want from life. They came from other people. And psychologists will tell you 70% or more of them are self-destructive, limiting, self-sabotaging. It's like, oh my God, the programs that we got in the first 7 years were so restrictive and took away power from us. So I say, well, okay, but I'll just pay attention. I won't be thinking so much. Well, science now has revealed a fact, and that is the average person thinks about 95% of the day. And many people up to 99% of the day are thinking. I say, what does that mean? It means like, well, since your conscious mind controls your life, and since it's operating less than 5% of the time, then by definition, your wishes and your desires and your aspirations are not running through your nervous system. What's running through your nervous system are programs that you got, especially the fundamental ones in your first 7 years of life. And all of a sudden it says, yeah, but if these are self-destructive or something like that, I'd be very, I'd see it. I go, no, that's the reason. The reason why you don't see it is, where's your conscious mind? Oh, it was in a thought. Well, then it was in a thought. It wasn't observing the behavior. And I go, absolutely. And as a result, 95% of the average person's day, all of us, 95% of us, are playing programs from the subconscious because our conscious minds are engaged in thinking. But if these programs are self-sabotaging and limiting, then we have a problem. That means that when we're not paying attention, we're sabotaging wherever we want to go, health or relationship or whatever. We're sabotaging it because the programs are playing and you're not paying attention. And you don't see it because you're not paying attention. So you're the one that thinks, oh my God, I'm having a struggle in life and nature is against me, the universe against me, it's not in my cards, whatever, and not realizing that 95% of the day you were shooting yourself in the foot and you were the one that didn't see it. And you come home with this bloody foot going, God, nature is against me, universe against me, I'm a victim. I'm a victim of life, it's not working. And all of a sudden I say, oh my goodness. I tell this story, Gary, in my lectures, and most people laugh because they're familiar with it. And the story is simple. I say, look, when you were younger, you probably had a friend, and you were very close to your friend. You knew your friend's behavior very, very well. And guess what? You knew his or her parent. And at some point, you see that your friend has the exact same kind of behavior as their parent. So, you volunteer something casually, like, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. And then you back away from Bill, because Bill goes ballistic. How can you compare me to my dad? most people laugh. And I go, listen, this is the most profound story. Why? Everybody else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. The only one who doesn't see it is Bill. And he's the guy who's, like, arguing, I'm not like my dad, but he's the one that didn't see it. And the next most profound point is we are all Bill. Every day we are playing these programs. They are invisible. And if they're invisible, that means you have no recognition or cognizance of the fact that these behaviors that you're playing are most likely taking you away from health and that destination you want so much. But if you don't see it, then you perceive yourself as a victim. And the idea about this, your programming is not something new. As I mentioned, the Jesuits have known for 400 years, and I can control you. Gary, so many of the things you talked about that we're facing in crises, and especially the loss of family. The loss of family is the continuation of a loss of what? Community. The significance is if you break up community, there's no power in the people. And when you finally break up family, you've removed all the power from people. And this is the issue. We have a perception of being victims. We have a belief that we are not responsible for those things because we had great wishes and desires, so that's what we were moving forward with. But a complete absence of understanding that our lives are actually been programmed, and the fact is that most of these behaviors are all disempowering. And it's very interesting because in the movie The Matrix, they say, well, okay, listen, we have two pills here. We have the blue pill and the red pill. If you take the blue pill, you'll go back into the programming, the Matrix, and everything will be just the way it's always been. But if you take the red pill, you'll get out of the program. I'm going to like to suggest right now that so many of the listeners out there have taken the red pill at one point in their life and didn't know it. They took a red pill without knowing it and stopped playing the program. And the consequences were the most amazing experiences of life. And when was that? Well, we now know a very important fact, is that when somebody falls in love, that first hit of being in love, it's profound. I mean, obviously, every day your life is a struggle, problem, struggle, 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 problems, and then one day you meet this person, and like the next day, it's like, oh my God, life is great. Heaven on earth, everything is beautiful. I love everything is great. And I go, wait a minute. You had all this struggle, and then in 24 hours later, all of a sudden, it's like the honeymoon. Everything is beautiful and lovely. And that switch is the action of the red pill. And in this case, the red pill was being in love. I said, well, how did it work? And I go, when you find something that you've been looking for your whole life and is now in front of your face, the mind actually starts staying mindful, meaning everything you want is right there, so you stop thinking, now you're living. And I go, yeah, but you got your hands on the wheel. You're driving with what? Conscious mind. I go, yeah, what's that? Wishes and desires. I go, oh, my God, you fell in love. You started experiencing wishes and desires. I go, and what happened? I said, well, the day before and up to that moment, 95% of the day you're running from the programs of disempowerment. The day you fall in love, you stay mindful. The default doesn't kick in. Now you're running your own biology with your own wishes and your own desires. And what did you manifest? This beautiful experience called the honeymoon. And I go, wow. And you created heaven on earth. Wow. And I say, how'd you do that? And you stop playing the program.
Or you get divorced.
Well, the divorce...
Right after the honeymoon. That's when people should divorce.
There's a reason. And it's simple. I'll just finish it with this reason, Gary. And this reason is this. When you and the other person have met, fell in love at that moment, you were both operating from what? Conscious minds. Wishes and desires minds. You treated each other as you would love to have been treated, and it was beautiful. Then I say, in a short period of time, too short for most people, life's still going on, even if you're on the honeymoon. You got a job, you got to pay the rent, you have to fix the car, you got chores, you got these things. I go, well, what's happening? And I say, the moment you start thinking about these things that you have put off because you were so much in love, the moment you start thinking, guess what? Your behavior is now not coming from your wishes, desires, conscious mind. It starts coming from your subconscious, and you don't see it. And I go, well, what's the relevance? Well, since most of that behavior is terrible behavior, I give you an example. My loved one comes up. We're having this great honeymoon. She asked me this wonderful question. I'm thinking about, as I said, fixing the car. I turn around and go, blah, blah, blah. And she looks at me and goes, and this is the whole breakdown. Ready? She looks at me and goes, who are you? Where did that behavior come from? Now you have to realize here's where the whole thing breaks and falls apart. And that is, whatever I just said to her, it came from my subconscious program. I go, yeah, boy, it was relevant. Because my conscious mind was busy. I didn't even hear what I just said to her. So I had no idea, except, like, I can't believe I would have said that.
Okay, Bruce, let me get some questions in here that I think are germane to what you're saying. And if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Dr. Bruce Lipton, L-I-P-T-O-N, and we're talking about epigenetics. And Bruce, there are five areas I'd like to discuss in the remainder of the program. So if we could use some examples and then show the significance of epigeneticism to these examples, I think it could be very helpful to people listening, all right? So first up, I believe, and this is far afield from what we're talking, but I find a huge error in conventional medical research today in its inability to bridge the gap between biomolecular and genetic activity and quantum physics and biophysics. And these disciplines seem to continue to stand worlds apart, and medical science still largely ignores the fact that underlying all biological and cellular operations, we discover energy, atomic particles, electrical and electromagnetic pulses, vibrations and frequencies. And we're likely familiar with the work of Gerald Pollack at the University of Washington, who has been studying for many years the fourth state or fourth phase of water. And we usually think of water existing in only three states, solid, liquid, and gas. However, the discovery of a fourth state, which Pollack says is the state of water in all of our cells, is the electrically charged and has its own distinct properties, such as unique vibrational frequency. So medicine does not acknowledge this, business does not acknowledge it, education does not acknowledge it, and yet we have all felt this special type of vibration. And then I want to see how this connects with quantum theory and the science of electromagnetism for understanding epigenetic functions that would relate to the power of thought and mind to influence our health. And then how can this be related to why there is a substantial amount of scientific evidence indicating that prayers, meditation, and spiritual practices can have a profound impact upon our DNA? Now I'm going to give you the example. Recently I did a retreat as a fundraiser for our sister station in WBI in New York. Unbeknownst to me, there was a woman who was observing everything, who happens to be one of the most respected and successful orthodox oncologists, cancer doctors in the United States, and at a major university where she is a professor. She had brought a terminally ill patient so advanced that she said to me later that I didn't think she would live on the trip. She would die in the plane trip. They had tried everything orthodox medicine had, and nothing would work, and the woman was in excruciating pain, limited, fatigued, etc., and would die within hours. I simply used a concept I've used my entire adult life, and that was try to shift the energy. Now, what do I mean? Now, I have never shared this with you before, Bruce. In fact, I just for the first time presented this last Friday when I filmed this. I believe that what we have been missing in the equation of healing and success in living, relationships, work, anything, are five principles, all vibrational. One, have the right idea. Two, have the right support system, people in your life who harmonize with you. Three, be in the right place. Four, be the right person. And so in the last, right idea, right place, right time, right support system, be the right person. And when all five of those energies are harmonizing, the harmonics of life, suddenly everything seems to flow because there's no limitation in the energy, not just to the individual, but the people who are a part of it. So there's a harmonizing of vibrations. I look at it much like a symphony. You could have 70 great musicians in a concert hall, but don't have the conductor there, and watch how there's no harmony. And yet individually, they could all get up there and give a concert. And so it's the harmonizing of energies. And think how many times in life you've had the right ideas of what to do, and but you didn't have the right people to do it with. So it didn't happen. Or you had the right idea, the right people, but maybe you weren't ready in your own life. Maybe there were issues you were still contending with. Now, why do I say that's important? Because the very first thing I do with every terminal person who sits across from me, and I only counsel and work with terminally ill people, is I ask them, what do you still have to live for? And more often than not, they say nothing. And I say, then let's see what you've missed in your life that if you could start all over again, you could do. And that harmonizing, where they thought there was nothing more to live for, they didn't have a support team, the doctor said, you got to go home and die, here's your narcotics. It was the wrong time, you know, it was at the end of their life, not the beginning when they could change it. So everything's working against them. But if only one of those five were working against you, it stops it. So by being with a person in the right environment, with the right people, with the right energy, and letting the person believe in something maybe they haven't, that they have yet to live their own authentic life. Because the one common denominator in almost all people at death is, if only I would have lived my own life the way I wanted to. Ask anyone who works in hospice care and they'll tell you this. So now you work with that person, lo and behold, after you start showing them all the things that they could do from the conversation you have with them, and you present only positive vibrations, only positive energy, the food, organic and positive, the juices, organic and positive, the environment itself, being able to pet a goat or look out at trees, positive and energizing. Lo and behold, that woman lives another 65 days without pain, complete mental clarity. And when she did pass, her husband reaches out and says, I cannot tell you the value of having my wife fully conscious without pain that I could share those incredibly important days with. Now, the doctor writes me a letter, I read it on the air, where it changed her perception of medicine, and where she's now cannot practice medicine the same way. She wants to go now and work in an ashram and deal with Ayurvedics and natural techniques, because she sees that of all the thousands of persons she's treated, she did the best she could, wrong idea, with the wrong support system, oncologists who believe in the wrong idea, even though they have the right intent, and hence patients die, but they're rewarded. So being rewarded for making the wrong choices also plays into this. And that's why we believe in people that we know are not going to do the right thing, like politicians, and that our bankers care about us, they don't. And the food we're told to eat on television is all disease-producing. Wrong harmonics. So finally, one example, and I'm only using this as one example. Think of the men and women in this country who get into a relationship. They fall in love, as you just said. They believe they've taken the red pill, as you just mentioned. But now, after the passion, whether it's the passion of joy, the oxytocin from holding hands, bonding, sexual contact, now something goes wrong. They don't get something they expect, even if what they said they expect is not verbalized, but someone doesn't say something, and suddenly the person attacks them, mercilessly attacks them, trying to destroy their belief in themselves, destroy the other person, and then comes back later and says, oh, I'm sorry about that, but when I was being raised, my father didn't give me the love I wanted or was abusive in some way, so that's why I'm doing it. So how then does a person who repeatedly does this and then wonders why they're lonely, and every relationship they go into, they're going to do the same thing over and over again, self-sabotage, but never take responsibility. At the end of the day, they're blaming everyone for their plight. And that is millions of men and millions of women today. That is politicians. That is people in businesses. They never look at the fact when the business was failing, they're the ones who were in charge. So what do? They take a golden parachute. They get out and they go run another business. They fail up. The people in the business who had no responsibility and no control, they fell out, but they're helpless because part of their epigenetics is, well, you're not in power, you're not in control, you're not a leader, so therefore, you know, adapt to your failing. And so we maladapt to our failings by sublimating, and one of the ways we sublimate is drink. Others take drugs, others take tranquilizers, others complain, others to distract ourselves by looking at people's lives who are more miserable than ours, reality television, by believing in things that are so far-fetched, like The Secret, you know, throwing beautiful waves of energy in the universe and it's going to come back and make us rich or heal us. And so then we look at the average person who has failed at many things, so successful maybe in their career, successful with their personality, but they're not connecting and vibrating with what is authentic to themselves, but rather they have maladaptive to a altered life. They've succeeded at an altered life. And I could have you sit beside me, Bruce, when I'm counseling billionaires who are grossly insecure, who are clueless about the meaning of their own life, but they've succeeded at a life that they created, and now they don't want to leave it, and hence they learn nothing, and they wonder why they have cancer. And those are the ones who don't succeed with the treatment. Does any of this make sense that I just shared with you? And if so, please address it.
I wish I had so many hours to go there, but if I can try to summarize a couple of things. We'll first start with the idea is the world that medicine is operating by is a world that's controlled by money. It's controlled by the pharmaceutical industry, medical school research, and all the kinds of donations from pharmaceutical industries shape the policy of a medical school. They influence, as you well know, the AMA is in bed with them, and the FDA is in bed with them. And I say, well, what's the relevance of that? And the relevance is that if they could put energy into a capsule or a tablet, they would sell you energy medicine right now. But you can't unitize it, you can't sell it, so it has no practical value and it undermines the profit motive of the industry. And so what's the point? They keep it out of the medical school. I say, keep what out? And I say, there's been scientific evidence. I've been in the field since the 60s. There's research all the time about energy, vibration, and fields controlling every aspect of biology. And I say, yeah, it's in scientific journals, but it's not in the medical school because it's not in the interest of pharmaceutical, that stuff would take away their sales, and so they don't bring it into the system, and since they own the media, they don't advertise it, and newspapers have a difficult time even writing articles about this stuff because of, hey, where's the money coming from? So, does energy work? And the answer is not only it work, but there was a wonderful scientific study from a physicist at the University of London, and he compared signaling through chemistry, like drugs, versus signaling through energy, and came out with a clear resolution that said that cells respond to energy signals. And in fact, energy signals are nearly 100% more efficient in controlling biology than our chemical signals such as drugs. And so the significance is that energy signals are not only used by the cells, but they're the most efficient means of communication. Biology and quantum physics have now revealed how quantum energy entanglement, the nature of quantum physics, is now engaged in the actual movements of the molecular nature of life. So there's a business that says, buy the chemical drug. And there's a science that says, that's nice, but that's trouble. If you want to heal, you have to go to the energy. And I say, well, how powerful is the energy? Then a simple quote from Albert Einstein, the field, the energy, the field, is the sole governing agency of the particle. The field, the energy, is the sole governing agency of particle, matter. And so what's the relevance? Quantum physics says, well, Newtonian physics, the classical understanding of pharmaceutical and medicine today, is based on there's a physical reality and it's not connected to the invisible realm. And so therefore, if you have a physical body, it's got to be dealt with by physical means. That's Newtonian physics. The quantum physics comes in and says everything is energy, and the energy field around is profoundly important in shaping the physical bodies. So basically, it says quantum physics completely crashes the idea of our conventional medical model and comes in and says that the energy fields that you are generating through your intention and your thought are not just influencing your internal biology. And I can tell you this because there's a new technology. We can read brain function by putting wires on a person's head, and I can show you electrical activity. It's called electroencephalograph. But that's because the electrical activity of the brain is being conducted physically to the skin, and that's how I'm reading it. But there's a new device to read brain function. It's called magnetoencephalograph. And the relevance about that is the probe doesn't even touch the head. The probe is outside, and it's reading the brain function inside. And I say, well, what's the relevance of that? And the answer is this. Your thoughts, which are electromechanical energy fields, are not contained in your head. They're broadcast out into the field. And why is that relevant? Well, you're not only then making a field which is controlling the matter of your own body, you're also generating a field out in front of you as well. And quantum physicists since 1930 have said, look, the universe is not like a great machine. It's more like a great thought. It's consciousness. So we've been living under an illusion, and this illusion has to end because that self-empowerment comes back. And then the biggest issues that we just talked about, and many of them about, you know, people who are trying to, you know, get somewhere and can't get there, people who get there and then are failing inside and all that, really has to do with another thing, and this is specifically about health issues, and that is this. My conscious mind is the mind where placebos come from. And let me just at this very important point. Placebo is a positive thought that is manifested when you take a drug, even if it's a sugar pill. It was the thought that manifested that created the healing. So it was thought that manifested healing. And then you say, well, that's a positive thought. What about a negative thought? Nobody talks about that. And to me, that's the most important one because the positive thoughts, placebo effect, great. Negative thoughts, it's got a name called nocebo. And basically, what does it represent? Total disempowerment. As much as a positive thought can empower your life, a negative thought can create any disease and can cause your own death. It's equally powerful, but it works in the opposite direction. Thought. It's been left out of medicine. Again, why? There's no pills and drugs that they've been able to work with, so leave it out of the story. We don't have to deal with it. But the fact is this, we must deal with it. Because quantum physics says that invisible stuff that you call the field, and what is the definition of the field? This is fun, definition of the field. Invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. And then I go, well, interesting, you know, there's a word spirit. Let's see, definition. Invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. It's like, yeah, the invisible realm has been left out of the entire story, and it turns out not that it's just been left out, but it is the more powerful realm in shaping the physical world. And so thoughts like this become important. I say, so what's the issue with the healing? I say, I got a very positive thought in my mind. I want to heal myself, but it's not working. I don't know why it's not working. I go, yes, and we brought it up previously, and it's the same thing. And that is this. How much time are you spending in your conscious mind with that positive thought? Because the moment you stop being in the conscious mind starts to start thinking again, you default to the program. And I say, what's the program? And this is the killer. The program is most everybody in growing up has learned a belief system that when you're sick, you go to a doctor. The doctor heals you. And it's very interesting because in the program, nobody even says what the doctor does. It just says, we're sick. We have to go to the doctor. So what does a child download? If they're sick, and this is in the subconscious mind, if you're sick, you don't take care of yourself. Your program is you go to the doctor. And we also learned, as children, there are professional people and you're not. And therefore, when a professional person says something, their word is more true than what you might believe because they're professional. Put those two together, story. I'm sick. I could heal myself. That's the whole story, the whole biology. We had healing before medical schools. People healed themselves all the time. But now you put a monkey wrench in the belief system. The first step says, if I'm sick, the first thing I do is not heal myself. The first thing I do is I go to the doctor. Then comes the joke part, because nobody ever said what the doctor had to do. You just had to go. Relevant? How many people get well on the way to the doctor or sitting in the doctor's office, they get well? Why? Their subconscious, running the show 95% of the time, says no healing until you go to the doctor. So the moment you actually engage in that process, it unleashes the ability to heal yourself. So basically then the limitation says, I didn't go to the doctor. And then the second problem in our belief system is we have been programmed as youth that there are professional people and their words more important. So therefore, when a doctor makes a diagnosis, that becomes in your subconscious mind truth. And I go, yeah, but your conscious mind's rebelling. I go, yeah, but the conscious mind's working 5% of the time, so big rebel, not much going on. 95% you're what? Adhering to a program, what? Professional opinion is truth, and the doctor is your truth provider. And if the doctor says you're going to die in 30 days, then you have set a time clock based on a program of belief, and you will die in an approximate time of when the doctor said you would die. Not that you had to, but the program can keep you alive, and the program can kill you. And your issues with older people whose programs say, I have nothing left to do, is a program that says, I have no reason for living. That's a belief. And that belief is turned into chemistry, which will shut down the system. And so basically, it says, oh, my God, we've been so looking at this body as this mechanical device. I go, well, it basically is a mechanical device, but you left out there's a programmer, that's you, and you can drive the vehicle if you stay in the conscious mind and make it where you want to go, such as the honeymoon. But the moment you start thinking, you start to default to the program, and if the programs are disempowering and limiting, like what? A, you're not responsible for your health, the doctor is. B, the professional gives you opinion, that's the truth. So A, B, the doctor diagnosis now becomes the program of the subconscious mind that is working 95% of the day to manifest reality from your program.
Okay, finally, I appreciate that. Thank you, Bruce. Finally, address the idea that we are a nation obsessed with finding a partner that will be the missing part of our life to share love with, but more often than not, we're not sharing what is true love. It's highly conditional, it's based upon a lot of unrequited needs, and more often than not, it's coming from people who are grossly insecure. So it is inevitable that these people will sabotage. At the same time they're saying, I love you, they're also saying, but there's going to be the dark side of this coming as soon as I don't get something I want. And this is everywhere out there. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting understanding, because it basically says this. That programming period that I said from up to age 7, last trimester of pregnancy up to age 7 determines up to 50% of your personality, will determine your future health and programming and all this kind of stuff, right? Well, the idea about it is most of that programming is critical of us. Parents don't mean to do it, but they do it because it's like being a coach. I'm a parent. I'm a coach. I'm going to help my child. And I say, well, like what? And I say, well, a coach, there's a player on a team that's not performing well. The coach goes up and says, you don't deserve to be here. You're not, you know, you're not good enough. Who do you think you are? Giving them that, like, stuff. Well, if the kid's, you know, listening to the coach, he says, oh, yeah, I'm not working as hard. The coach wants me to work harder. And I go, great. But if you're under 7 years old and you get, look, you don't deserve this. Who do you think you are? You're not good enough. You're not worthy. A seven-year-old's mind, remember, is not working in consciousness. It's working in record, and it's putting in a program. What is the program? Not good enough, not worthy enough, not lovable enough. And I say, why is that relevant? Because 95% of your life, I don't care what the heck age you are, is going to run from that program. If you have a belief you do not deserve, then 95% of the day when your conscious mind is in thought, not paying attention, your behavior will sabotage your life so that at the end of the day, the belief is, I do not deserve, is now manifest. That's the way it works, okay? And so basically, the whole issue about this comes down to, when we, and I work with belief change modalities, these energy psychology ones, very interesting, we test a group with a belief statement. The first belief statement that I always like to test, that's for my own scientific interest, is the belief, I love myself. I can give you a fact from the numbers of times that I've done it, from 80 minimum to 90% of people will not test positive for I love myself. I say, what does that mean? I said, because the subconscious programs are all critical. Not good enough, not lovable, not worthy, not desirable, whatever these things are. And so a person has what? A lack of self-love. So what are they looking for? Love. And I say, well, where's the problem? Well, you're looking for somebody to feed something to you that you don't have. By definition, any relationship based on that motivation is called codependency. Codependency, why? I'm missing love. You'll give me love. If you don't give me love, I'm going to give you crap. It's basically, holy geez, a great relationship. It's not being run by conscious mind. It's being run by subconscious mind. And the conscious minds are only the ones that think about just what the hell happened after the subconscious mind sabotaged each other in these programs. So the issue is this. People will have a difficult time finding love until first, finding self-love. If you can't love yourself, then you are not open for a real loving relationship, because otherwise you're looking for a relationship that I'm going to trade something for love, and that's a bargain, that's a codependency thing, and if you don't give, I won't give, and it's like, oh my God, now there's a tug of war and all that. If you are satisfied with self-love, you don't need anybody else's love. I mean, it's
Bruce, we're all up literally to the end of our program. I just want to close with this thought with you, please. I believe that that we have to understand your message and those other messages, that it's also generational, that each generation seems to become more disconnected from itself and its collective humanity from the previous one. There was the greatest generation of our parents, I believe the most selfless, caring, high-quality character and moral. Then the baby boomers, our generation, which are both born into, Generation X from the early 60s to the early 80s, Generation Y, which goes up to the early 2000s, finally the millennials, who are coming into adulthood now. And with each generation, I observe what I can only describe as a further fragmentation of wholeness. And today, if you look at websites written by and about the 20-somethings, you find them critiquing themselves over their lack of empathy, a pursuit of self-gratification, drugs and booze, and the lack of what you and I and our parents would call deep romantic intimacy, love, and connecting and bonding. Moreover, according to the Pew Charitable Surveys on religious beliefs, this is the generation with almost a third professing atheism, and therefore that must have an impact. And finally, I believe that we also can benefit from collective unconscious development, and but also be victimized by it. The group mindset, especially if it's maladaptive and contributing to the sorry state of our society and nation and the humanity's negative effects upon the planet and all of life. Several years ago, Erwin Laszlo, who I know and you know personally, was on this program. And as you're aware, he speaks a great deal about the Akashic field, or what he calls the A field, that he describes as a quantum field of collective data or information that not only explains our current universe, but also attributes the development of humans. And I ask him, well, that's fine. Our positive thoughts and actions fed into this database, as it were, can contribute to our positive unfoldment. However, what about the far more numerous negative thoughts and negative actions that we read and hear about every day in the news, with all the violence happening around the world? Doesn't that also feed into the same quantum field and consequently have a negative impact upon collective humanity? And you've answered that tonight, where you said, yes, it does. We are also the dark side of our conditioning. And so from both sides, the positive that is possible or the negative, you have given us a great deal to think about. Thank you very much, Bruce, for being on the Progressive Commentary Hour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, and I really appreciate the audience who will be making differences in our world. Thank you.
I'm Gary Knoll for the Progressive Commentary Hour. Thank you all for listening.